Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking, meet the characters involved, hear their stories, and find some insight to help us all get faster on our bikes. This week, ex-pro rider, now-turned-coach, ambassador, and designer for Cro-Mag, Claire Bouchard, joins us for a chat. But first, a quick thank you to our supporting partners who enable us to keep bringing you the show. First up, thanks to Cushcore. We've had an amazing response to our episode with their founder and inventor, Adam Crefton. If you haven't listened yet, then check it out and find out why Cushcore is much more than just something to protect your rims. Cushcore is a game changer that's used by this year's EWS Men's Series leader, Martin Mays, and three-times world downhill champion, Loic Bruni, along with many others. I'm no Martin Mays, but I've fitted them on my trail bike and I was shocked by how much difference they've made to the bike, providing improved damping, increased cornering support, and an ability to carry more speed through the rough stuff. If you're interested, then head to cushcore.com and check them out. Next up is the Trailhead Bicycle Company, who are an awesome local bike shop based in Shrewsbury in the UK. Their owner, Sandy Plenty, has been on the podcast before, so make sure you check that out. Sandy strongly believes in the local bike shop being a super important part of its local riding community, and as a result, they've built up a really popular shop ride. It's a great way to get to ride some of the best trails that the Shropshire Hills have to offer, and it's a mixed group with a sociable pace so no one gets dropped. If you're ever in the Shropshire area on a Tuesday, then give it a go. They meet every other Tuesday at 6:45 p.m, and the ride generally ends up in the pub so you can have a drink and a chat afterwards. Details get posted on their social media, so make sure you follow @the_trailhead_bicycle_co on Instagram or The Trailhead Bicycle Company on Facebook. What's even better is that anyone who goes on the shop ride gets a 10% discount in the shop. If you want to support the podcast and help me keep it going, then you can grab yourself something from our web store at downtimepodcast.com/shop. Also, please keep spreading the word and telling your friends about the podcast. There is no marketing budget, so it's you guys and girls that help us grow. If you want any of the links that I mentioned in the episode, they'll be in the show notes over on downtimepodcast.com. Also, a really important message for you all. From now on, our tech and product focused episodes won't be featured anywhere other than our channels. So if you want to listen to those and you're not yet a subscriber, then it's time to join up. It's totally free and we have a webpage to help you at downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. If you're on an Apple phone, then I'd recommend the Apple Podcasts app. And if you're an Android device, then the Google Podcasts app is really good. Also, Spotify works great on both, so make sure to get yourself subscribed. All right, it's time for this week's episode. Claire Bouchard currently works at Cro-Mag Bikes and as a coach with Kvyat Racing. Her background saw her racing World Cup downhill, taking a bronze medal at World Champs, and also overcoming some pretty challenging hurdles. Claire's an inspiring lady, and I really enjoyed chatting with her. So, without further ado, here's Claire Bouchard. Claire Bouchard, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for taking some time out of your day for a chat.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's a pleasure. So let's start where we start a lot of these episodes and wind back to the beginning and maybe tell us a little bit about your childhood and then how bikes and riding came to be part of your life.
Okay, well, I had a pretty great childhood. I grew up in a pretty great part of the world. You know, like it was back then, playing outside, playing in the dirt, on the street, riding bikes around. There was no such thing as mountain bikes at that time. I think while I grew up in Lynn Valley, right? So on the North Shore of Vancouver. And so I guess that it started to grow, the sport started to grow there. And so that's kind of how I fell upon it. My older brother was into it and I needed an outlet because things then, and you know, when you're a teenager, things are are a bit up and down in your world and as a lot of families, ours fell apart and then I actually was dealing with a lot of loss, was I lost my mom at the age of, when I was 17. And then I lost my best friend like a year and a half later. And they were both big tragedies, like big tragic events in my life. So naturally when things like that happen, you go towards something you know. And my parents' values, I went straight back to their values that they taught us when we were kids and things were still good in the world. And that was, and I'll never forget that, you know, what this gift that they gave us was, you know, the outdoors and sport. And yeah, so that became my outlet. And I chose mountain biking because I needed something right then to, you know, put all that fuel and that energy into. So that's kind of like was my original approach to riding. And I never knew that it would take me to where I am now. I just needed somewhere to put some energy. So it worked out really well.
Yeah. Do you think that kind of extra energy that you were given by some of that tragic stuff that happened in your life at that time, do you think that helped propel you further to, like, you know, to push harder, to spend more time riding? Was it, did it create a positive? Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. So at the time I didn't know that I was turning something negative. Well, you know, I mean, I don't see it like that. It's just part of life, but I didn't know that I was using it into, you know, turning it into something very positive. As I was still so young, I didn't really know much about much. I was learning a lot. And yeah, like 100%, it contributed to, you know, that fire I had, that determination and drive. And oftentimes I've heard stories, while it's been documented that, you know, a lot of, like, you know, top athletes in the world, I'm not putting myself up there with them, but like, have had some hardships in their childhoods and in their lives. So I really do think that it's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense. I guess it's a reason for doing it, isn't it? It's a channel of energy into something positive to help with the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And was that initially, was that just, you know, literally getting out in the woods and trying to ride fast up and down hills, or did it quickly get into the racing side?
Yeah. So, well, I think, ever since I was a kid, so my parents were both athletic. My dad was an athlete. He was a professional athlete. He grew up in Czechoslovakia, it was back then. And he was a, alpine skiing national team member and, enduro motocross. He was definitely, I got my blood from him. And my mom was also competitive. And so I always had that as a kid, and I was always good at sports. And I kind of took that for granted when I was a kid, like just being good at sports. Like I kind of always had that coordination and I picked things up. So yeah, it was, I obviously along the way, I fell in love with the movement. Like sport has always, and riding has always for me been like an expression of a movement, or like, it's hard to explain, like an expression of style or energy. And, you know, like how you move through the air, or, you know, I was in ballet or soccer, like how you move along the field and dribble the ball, or like, it's just a good feeling when you're good at something. And so, yeah. So obviously there's the element of being out in the woods and going on adventures. And, but a lot of it was just feeling good on your skis or feeling good on your bike. And it still remains to this day, like, you know, a good ride is a ride where, you know, you've had a, whatever kind of ride you've been on, there's always been a part of it where there's been a rad section of trail where you felt good in corners and on your bike. And like that to me is such a big part of it. But yeah, I also had that competitive drive. So I immediately started, like I didn't even know what I was doing yet on my bike. And I entered some races. But I had ski raced as a kid. So it was, you know, it was something I could relate to, like a point to point race. I went straight into downhill racing.
What age would you have been at that point?
By then I was, I think I'd say, like, I started late because I'd say 20.
Okay. Years old.
Yeah, I was never a junior. So I went straight into, like, you know, racing against the top women in Canada at the time.
Right. Yeah, dropped yourself in at the deep end then.
Yeah, totally. So, but racing, it just teaches you things so fast, right? You're forced to learn. So,
yeah. And what was your performance then like from the start? Were you initially pretty competitive, or did it take a while to get your head around how the race side of things works?
I think that I was, like, you know, although I wasn't very confident yet and stuff, but I think I did have some success, like early on. We didn't have a ton of competition in Canada, but there were still some rad girls, like, at that time, that were racing and that I looked up to. And they were, like, they definitely weren't slouches. I moved up the ranks pretty quickly. And I think a lot of that just had to do with, you know, I don't know, my past experience with sport. I just put my head into it and went for it. I was really kind of focused.
Yeah. At what point did you think, oh, hang on a minute, I'm pretty good at this. Maybe I could take this to a pretty serious level.
I really don't even know when that point was. it just started happening. Like, I just went to bigger races and then I think this is what happened, is I finished second at the national champs one year. I think this was 2003 or something. And that was my first kind of national event. And I didn't even really know that there was a national team. Like, I really was that clueless about it. And my friend Katrina Strand, who's a really good friend of mine to this day, comes up to me and she's like, "Hey, are you going to Worlds?" And I was like, "Huh?" And she's like, "Yeah, you made the world's team." And I'm like, "What's the world's team?" And so I looked into it and I was like, "Oh my God, I got to go to this." And I had zero money, but I just somehow made it happen. And I went and I had a really shitty time because I got sick and it was horrendous, but overall a pretty good experience in the end, like, learned a lot. But,
so your first World Cup was World Champs then?
Yeah. That was my first, like, yeah.
And what venue was it? Can you remember?
That was in Capoon. And it would have been, well, maybe it was 2000. I don't remember what year it was. It was when the track was, because we went back there the following year or the year after, and the track was shortened in half. I don't know when it was, 2002, maybe?
Yeah. A good few years ago. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, so that obviously, yeah, maybe not the experience you'd hope for, but like you say, you learned a lot from it. Was that the turning point where you decided you were gonna have a crack at racing World Cups?
I think I just knew that I wanted to, like, I was like, well, that sucked, but it kind of fueled my fire to to keep going. And it's funny how many times in the course of my career I've had really, really so many, like, big lows, and I've never given up. Like, it kind of blows my mind that I didn't give up. And I don't know, but I think that's what happens with athletes. They just, you know, get back up. And yeah, I don't know. First, I had something to prove. I don't know. So I just kept going.
Yeah. There's clearly a fire burning inside you. And you were a privateer for quite a lot of your time at World Cup level, yeah?
I was, and I think a lot of people don't know that. I've never been paid to actually, like, just race my bike.
Okay.
So I was. I've had my expenses paid, like my travel and stuff paid. But for a couple years when I was on CRC Intense. And like maybe some small bits of money here and there, but never anything to feed myself with, or like, right, you know, to be able to focus just on racing. No, yeah. I always had a full-time job. Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you think it takes as a privateer to succeed? Because there's a lot of things to manage when you've not got a big team behind you looking after you.
Oh man, it's I guess what I had, that fire and that drive, and it was a time. Like I would show up and I would be exhausted in the start gate. Like by the time the race came around, I was like falling asleep in the start gate. It's a lot of work.
Wow.
And a lot of times I would travel so far and get a front flat, and it was devastating, you know, like
yeah, it's a lot of work, isn't it, to go somewhere and have a mechanical.
Yeah, for sure. That was hard for sure. A lot of tears.
Yeah, for sure. And was it when you were on CRC Intense? Is that when you met Chris?
No, I met him before. I met him in 2005 when he was here in Whistler for Crankworks. And and so that whole CRC Intense thing obviously came about for me because a large portion was because of him, because I was, you know, Chris and I were an item, and so that really influenced their decision to bring me on board. But I think in the end, I did my part, and I made a difference for the team, and we won some overalls and stuff like that. So, but man, what a difference when you can show up and, you know, have everything almost taken care of for you. I learned a lot in those 2 years, more than I had in all the other years of my racing. Like I was starting to progress, you know, a lot quicker. I was still learning, but I was still, yeah, I learned a lot in that short amount of time.
Did that support enable you to kind of get to the start gate and not be ready to go to bed?
Exactly. 100%. I still, there's so much that was taken care of. It was unbelievable. It is so new to me. And like, I tried to tell Chris, like, you know, what it's like, because he was never really a privateer. He always, he was picked up at a young age by a team, and so he never really knew what it was like to be a privateer, and I tried to explain it to him how different it is. And yeah, it's definitely, we have different, I don't know, it taught me a lot about just not feeling like I'm entitled to anything, and you know, it taught me a lot about just working hard and not being owed anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes a lot of sense. And it worked out with a pretty good result for you, didn't it? Yeah. Was it bronze medal at Champrix Worlds 2011? Is that your best kind of World Cup race or World Champs race?
I finally podiumed in South Africa I think it was 2009 or 2010. I was fifth there, so that was my best World Cup result. And and then the team went to Nuke Proof the following year. So in 2011, when I was bronze, when I won a bronze in Champrix, I actually didn't have a team. I was back as a privateer. And I hadn't raced any World Cups that year just because we couldn't afford it. So Chris and I were, that was his first taste of being a privateer in 2011.
Right.
And we didn't really make it to any World Cups. And I raced here. I raced our national champs and won. And then that's how I made the team to go to Worlds. And I decided to go. And I'm glad I did. Yeah.
And that was that the year that it was super wet for finals.
Yeah, it was like the craziest conditions ever. The race was delayed an hour and a half. We were like really hungry. We were starving. I remember me and Miranda Miller were at the top of the track, and she's like, I'm hungry. And I remember feeling, cause you know, like you time everything so that you're good to go, but people were just axing themselves. Like the juniors were all axing themselves, and the tracks are so steep that the only way to get them off was to heli them off. So there was this huge delay before the elite women went. So we're all like, were kind of, I think it kind of helped in a way, because we're all like, oh God, this is such a shit show. Like, and we were kind of just like, you know, laughing about it. But I still, like inside, I still remained really focused and determined. So, yeah.
Was there anything that kind of clicked into place on that particular event that kind of helped you get there? Because I'm guessing, I don't know, were you expecting a good result having not raced any of the World Cups that year? Like, how are you feeling?
Not really. Like, I had never, I don't know, like I never had that confidence. Like, you know, when you get a good result and then you build momentum on it, because I'd been off the circuit, I had no idea where I'd be, and I was just going to try to do my best. And you know, like I didn't make it down the mountain without incident. Like nobody did, but I guess I think what really helped me is I put flat pedals on and I still boosted all the jumps, and even though there was like massive cross ruts going into the jumps, like I don't think I would ever hit that nowadays, but back then I was just way more brave and yeah, it was, you know, I just kind of, I guess, like, I rode smart too. So, I just remember being like, well, you know, at the bottom, like, oh, everyone crashed out. And that's why I did so well. Like, I always have doubted myself like that. And then, you know, who said something to me? My idol, Anne Caroline Chausson, was there. She was in the SRAM pits, and I was taking shelter from the rain watching the men's race after I had just finished third at the World Championships. And I was just like, it hadn't kicked in yet. And she actually said to me, she's like, congratulations, Claire. And I was like, oh, you know, and I started saying, yeah, well, everyone crashed. And she's like, no. Like, she kind of told me that, no, you deserve this. You rode smart, and that's a huge part of it. And so I was just like blown away. I don't really get starstruck, but she's like, I just get starstruck with her. Well, she's just, I've always looked up to her, and to have her say that to me really kind of made a huge difference. And yeah. And I thought back on it and I was like, yeah, you know, I did ride smart, and I, you know, I handled it. Like, I handled the shit. And so I kind of, I know, I gave myself more credit for sure.
Cool. And do you think that the lack of kind of personal expectation that you had helped your mindset for the event, because you weren't coming off the back of, you know, other good kind of World Cup results that season? You didn't have that, like, I deserve a third here kind of mentality going in.
Well, I don't know. Like, that's true, you know, like you do get a certain amount of pressure put on yourself. And I would feel that back home in Canada. And I had never, well, I mean, I guess I did feel pressure when I was racing World Cups. I put it on myself a lot. But no, I think I was thinking in the way that, you know, if you come off a good result, you've got momentum, you've got this confidence. And I think I really lacked that confidence a lot when I was racing World Cups. And it's a confidence that I have now that I wish I had back then. It was just kind of, mm-hmm. you know, that development was bad timing, I guess. But for that particular race, I think it may have helped that it was just such a gong show that, you know, you kind of relaxed a little bit more going in, and you're like, well, here I go. But you still, I mean, it was gnarly. It was like, you didn't know if you were going to make it down the mountain, and half the time you were sliding off on, you know, off of the track anyway. So I don't know. It was just, I mean, you had to stay focused, and it definitely was scary, that track in those conditions. But
yeah, I remember watching it on the live feed or whatever it was. I think it was Freecaster at the time. And yeah, I was pretty glad to not be riding down it in those conditions.
Yeah, the flat pedals really helped though. So I'm glad that I could, like, I had the skills to on my flats to be able to switch.
Yeah. And are you kind of generally a clips rider still now, or do you tend to flick between them?
I pretty much only ride flats, like when I ride my dirt jumper.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. And then, so you got back from that season and started to struggle a bit with low energy. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm sure I read that somewhere. Tell us a little bit about what you went through with that.
That had started happening, now that I look back, like on and off before. And I think it's a result of, all the trauma as a teenager, and then jumping into this sport and just going for it, and all the travel, and, you know, being a privateer, it was a lot of hard work. And then just not really like properly dealing with the trauma that I did experience, like not processing it enough. And then just all the, like, I was pretty much burnt out. I wasn't very old. And so when I was training, because we were going to do some World Cups, Chris and I, and I was training, it was the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, and I just at the gym, and I just couldn't make it through my workout, and I was like, this is so weird, this is definitely not right. And so I started investigating and going to doctors and naturopaths, and I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition. And basically that just means, well, it means a lot of things, but I had a lot of healing to do. And my adrenals were tired, and my thyroid, like my whole system wasn't working efficiently. And I was just really, really tired. And yeah, so that started, I mean, it's a really long story, but that kickstarted an entire healing journey that I'm still on today. But I mean, to make a long story short, I changed a lot of things in my diet and my lifestyle. And I actually baffled the doctors, because they told me that I would be on medication for the rest of my life. And something in my gut said, no, doesn't feel right. And I actually went off of medication, like 2 years ago. And
awesome.
When they asked me, like when I went in for my regular checkup, they asked me, well, you haven't got a prescription from us for a while. And I said, oh yeah, well, I went off the medication. And they're like, oh my God, we need to get your blood tested. And I was like, okay. And we went in, I got it tested. And when it came back, they were blown away, because without the medication, my numbers were in the normal range. Like, they were just on the cusp. Like, I still have work to do, but they were like, I had done it without medication. I had done it with diet changes and lifestyle changes. So,
Awesome.
So they were really, they were baffled, because I guess that's not really how those doctors were taught to think. And,
So can you tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've changed, maybe some of the more significant things in like diet and that side of stuff?
I immediately took out gluten and dairy, and those are two big things, and then refined sugars, like things that my body was reacting to negatively. And I brought in, because I took those things out, you can bring in more, this is the gist of it, you can bring in more vegetables, therefore you get more, like fruits and vegetables, so therefore you get more nutrient dense meals. So I started healing. There's certain supplements I've been taking, like zinc concentrate, B12, like there's some adrenal support. So not many supplements. Most of the stuff I get from my food. I started eating as much organic as I could. And now that I have been like, I don't eat meat anymore, fully vegan. That's for other reasons too. Like environmental and just animal, like ethical reasons. It wasn't hard for me to transition to that though, because I had already not eaten dairy for so long. So it's been a bit of a process. Okay. But all these things, these have been mostly, plant-based diet.
Yeah. And have you done much with sleep? Have you kind of looked at that and tried to improve it?
Totally. Listen, I've never really had a huge problem with sleep. But I tell you, like, my sleep has improved. Like, I sleep well, and I try to, get to bed, if I can, closer to 10 o'clock at night, and then be up a bit earlier, instead of going to bed at midnight and then being up later. I find that really helps. It's hard to do if you're having a busy day, but that really helps. So just getting enough sleep and good sleep, and just taking care of yourself, like this, managing, the stress that we have in life, that can like stress is huge. It's such a big part of it, and it can set you back for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And so you're obviously putting a lot of thought and effort into dealing with that and working through your nutrition and everything else that goes with it. And then along that journey, you had a pretty unfortunate car accident a few years ago.
Yeah, so that was a huge setback, because it was a massive hit to my like central nervous system, and it was a huge traumatic event. And how I dealt with it was, I think I was too quick to come back from it. Like, I treated it like it was any other injury, like a broken collarbone. Okay, 6 weeks and I'm back on my bike. But this was different. It rocked my central nervous system. I had vertigo. I came back to riding a bit too soon, but at that time, like that happened in 2013. At that time, I didn't know how else to deal with it. Like, I thought, well, I'll just get back to it as soon as possible. But looking back at it now, I should have taken more time. That whole accident and the drugs that you're given and everything, it set back my healing journey quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. 'Cause you had pretty serious injuries.
I sure did. Yeah. And of course, as soon as I woke up, like in the car, the first thing I thought of was, okay, Chris is alive. And then I just scanned my body and I was like, I have my legs. I can feel my legs and my limbs. So all I have to do is I just have to stay alive. Like I knew something was right. And I knew something wasn't right, because there was like warmth in my body, like internally, like my stomach and my lungs. So I knew there was something wrong inside. And that obviously I couldn't breathe. I had to I had to sip air until the ambulance arrived. So I just kind of was like, hey, I just got to survive. I just got to live and I'll be all right.
Yeah.
And then, wow, the doctors, and I tell you, I'll never, I'll always be so thankful and grateful for, our doctors and our nurses. And I mean, this happened in Australia, but anywhere, they put me back together. Like, it was unbelievable what they did for me. And I think that, You know, like there's our doctors, there's a place for them. And then there's a place for like holistic nutrition. So I really feel like I got a good picture of the whole health system.
Yeah, you've seen a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And do you think your kind of inner fire and your competitive nature helped with your recovery from both the crash and the kind of working on the autoimmune side of things, or hindered, or is it a balance?
Well, I guess it's a balance, but I think overall it really helps. And it's, you know, I think a lot of it is that positivity. And, you know, when I see it a lot, like an athletes have a shitty result, something super disappointing, or they crash, get an injury, you know, at first you're bummed, but then that fire starts burning again and you just, it turns into a positive and you're like, yeah, I can do this. And I got a few comments in the hospital from the doctors because I was in a room. I ended up, after I got out of ICU, I ended up in a room with a few other people that were, you know, not necessarily in their best health for their age. And, you know, they weren't fit. They weren't super healthy. They weren't that happy. And I think the doctors were really, it was refreshing for them to work with somebody like me who was just, you know, positive and ready to make it happen. And I was fit. So I was healing quickly and I was feeling positive about it. And I'm lucky that I have that, because if you don't feel good, you can't make those things happen, those other things happen. Like if you don't feel good in your head, you know, if you're sad or just over life, it's hard to heal, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So has that accident, has it changed your mindset? Like the way you approach things and think about things?
Oh, totally. I'm scared on the road still. Other drivers, because we were hit by another driver, like totally random. They were out of control. And of course, yeah, like those were big injuries and it was a big head injury, and it's taking me years. Like even though I went back to racing some races, it was too early, and it took me a long time to heal from that trauma. And yeah, I think to this day, like I still feel pain to this day. You don't just get hit by a truck, and it's not like crashing on your bike. It's like you just got hit by a truck going 80 kilometers per hour. Like that's totally a different league. And so yeah, I still feel pain. I have to take care of myself and do rehab and stuff like that.
Are you doing things beyond what you were already working on with all your kind of nutrition and that side of stuff? Is it just like a layer of rehab on top of that, or are there other things that you'd use to deal with the kind of the inflammation or the pain?
Well, the diet really helps for inflammation and pain, but yeah, I have to do like regular maintenance. I think I would do this anyways because I just love feeling like fit and good. So yoga really helps, and I do some like mobility rehab exercises to keep my shoulder, my right shoulders really got messed up from it. And then the whiplash is just kind of always there. So I have to, I have to work on that. And I'm actually still trying to figure out how to live without pain every day. I'm still actually going to seek out, I've got a couple people that I want to go and see. So in this town in Whistler, it's quite a normal thing. Like there's so many athletes and people that have skied and biked their whole lives, and they're just kind of like getting older and starting to feel the wear and tear. So yeah. I'm lucky that in this town there's a lot of like ex-athletes that have gone into health, and so yeah, there's some good resources just right here in town where I can get help, but acupuncture really, really helps me. What I have found is that my body responds the best to like something non-invasive and really gentle. So okay. It doesn't want any more poking and prodding and trauma. It wants something that is really like acupuncture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Wants you to be nice to
it. Yeah, totally. think,
which makes sense. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Good stuff. Well, and more recently, you guys, along with your husband, Chris, you've set up Kavaric Racing and a bit of a coaching business. Tell us a little bit about kind of the background behind that and how that started to come together.
Yeah. So actually we started that in 2011, just slowly, small. When CRC Intense kind of, they went to Nuke Proof and we stayed with Intense and we just started, well, what's Chris going to do now? This is kind of his trade, is riding bikes. And so we talked about it and he's like, yeah. And we got our coaching tickets and we started like coaching, and it's never been like a full-time thing. It's kind of just like a part-time hustle, but yeah, we really enjoy it. And it's kind of cool for us to share our knowledge and all our experience from racing, and especially love teaching. Like Chris has a few like young up and coming riders under his wing. And I think he really likes that. He finds it really rewarding. So yeah, it's a good gig for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. So as a coach, are there like common mistakes that you see people making?
Yeah, for sure. Like you'll see the red flags, and a lot of it stems from like the most foundational skill out there, which is, you know, body position. So yeah, I think, you know, people always are like, I want to learn how to do jumps and drops. They always want to learn, of course, right? Because that's like really fun. And so oftentimes you're like, well, I can't teach you how to do that until you learn body position properly. And people are so disappointed because they've been riding for so many years and didn't really realize that they had a really bad habit that makes everything else that they do unsafe and sketchy. So
and what does the right body position look like? Is it something you can explain on a podcast, or is it like you need to kind of be with someone on a bike kind of moving them around?
Well, no, I think you can explain it. It's good when I can explain it and demonstrate it at the same time, but I think it's like, you know, your pedals are level, your heels are slightly dropped, your legs are just slightly bent. So they're not fully locked out, and you're not squatting, because who can hold a squat for, you know, and then you're hinged at the hips. So your legs are just slightly bent, and you actually hinge at the hips. You leave your kind of like butt where it is and hinge at the hips, and that brings your chest down, your elbows out, and then you look ahead. So a lot of people, instead of hinging at the hips, they bring their hips forward and then they stay upright, and it kind of brings your elbows in. And it is actually kind of hard to explain it on a podcast, but
no, yeah. And I think a lot of people struggle with that hip hinge. Like if you spend your whole day sat at a desk or driving a car or whatever, you start losing your mobility. And I've certainly noticed improvements in my position just through doing some kind of gym based work and improving that hip.
Yeah,
hinge.
For sure. Yes, you're right. And I releasing those muscles that aren't giving you that full range of movement.
Cool. And what about bike setup? Because obviously you get to ride with lots of different people if you're coaching. Do you see a lot of people making common mistakes in the way they set their bikes up?
Yeah, like we always start, like if it's a new client, we always start with bike setup, and like right away I look at their bars and their brakes, just to make sure like they're their hand position is good, or the length, the width of their bars is good, how it's, you know, the length of their stem. But most, like most, you know, current modern bikes have a pretty decent cockpit. And then of course I always find that they have no idea what tire pressures they're running.
Yeah.
And that's like so important, because it's like, that is the first contact with the ground. Like that's your connection with the ground. And it can make such a huge difference with your riding and how comfortable you are. And then suspension, things like that.
Yeah. With brake positioning, is there a right and a wrong answer, or is it like a personal preference?
Definitely some of it's personal preference, but it depends too on like if it's a beginner rider, sometimes, yeah, you'll tell them, well, you know, brakes these days, you don't need to use two fingers. You can just use one. They're strong enough, and you can have an extra finger on the grip. And, but yeah, like a lot of it's personal preference with like the angle of your brakes. I know for me with smaller hands, like I can't always reach my shifter. So I got to put it on the inside of my brake.
Yeah.
Or outside. I don't know how you want to explain that.
I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. Trying to get it closer to the grip so that you can reach it, kind of thing.
And, you know, little tips like that and adjustments that you can like, that can really help their ride.
And alongside that, you're working at Cro-Mag Bikes as well.
Yeah. So I started working there like pretty casually in 2014. And just as, you know, more inside sales and a bit of graphics. It was cool because Ian had me start with some sales stuff just so I could get to know the brand and how it worked and all the products. And then as we grew, I started doing more graphics and things like that, because that's what I went to school for. And then slowly I just had less and less time for the sales. There's just too much work. I went to full-time graphics. Yeah. And now we have another guy doing graphics, so we're growing quickly.
Yeah, and you've been responsible for a lot of the clothing range.
Yeah, so I do. I help with a lot of products and graphics and packaging, all sorts of things. But yeah, I've helped a lot with their soft goods and graphics for that, and different styles, all the different styles, and yeah, the whole line.
Yeah. It looks like a cool place to work. I've seen a couple of articles about it, and it looks a bit different to your average office.
Definitely. It's like, it's pretty funny. Like I don't dread going there. It's always, you're always like laughing hysterically at some point during the day. So it's pretty fun.
Awesome. One thing I wanted to ask you about as well, you're effectively a brand ambassador, I guess, for a few big brands. And there's a lot of people out there, a lot of young riders that want to become ambassadors and want to get support from brands. What advice would you give to people that are looking to get into that kind of position? What does a good brand ambassador look like in your eyes?
I think the difference between, you know, like it being like a serious position where you can actually, you know, make a bit of money from it, is to have a background where in competing, and getting some good results and some credibility that way. So I don't know, like, I mean, you don't have to be a racer, but I think it helps a lot if you've had some of that experience behind you and some good results behind you. And then you can build from there. And But either way, you have to have a lot to offer. So, you have to, you kind of have to be a good all-rounder and be out there influencing people, be involved in the community, like working directly with people through coaching. And then, of course, these days, especially hustling on social media and in the media, it's such a big part of it. Yeah. Like, I think all of our contracts pretty much have a paragraph in there about social media. So it's changed so much. Like, what being an athlete means now to, even 10 years ago has changed so much, and I'm still trying to figure it out.
Yeah, definitely big changes, and lots of big changes in mountain biking as a sport over the time that you've been involved with it. Sure. Has being a woman in the mountain bike world, have you seen a lot of change in that over the time you've been involved?
Totally. I think these days, there's a lot more respect and recognition. I used to tell Chris, I was like, hey, I was out there because I'm not as fast as him. So, if you think about like the Fort William track or something, and say I'm like, I don't even know how much slower I am than him, like a minute, say. And if I'm like, hey, I was out there for a minute longer than you, I worked harder. I'm like going as hard as I can for a minute longer than he is. I don't know. It's like we do work as hard and we do risk as much. And I totally get that there's just not as much competition in the women's field, but it's still the competition that's there is still strong. It's really nice to see that women are getting more and more respect, and not just from other women, but also like young kids are growing up respecting women in sport. So I think that's a lot different from when I was a kid playing in the street. It was very segregated, like girls do this and boys do this, and now it's a little bit more blended in to each other.
Definitely, yeah. And what are there areas within mountain biking that you think still need to be improved? What could be better about that side of things?
I think, women, how they get together and they start creating. And I definitely believe in women-specific events and things like that, for sure. There's definitely value and a place for that. But I think when it's taken too far, women can end up segregating ourselves further from, we want equality, but then we just end up shooting ourselves in the foot by separating ourselves further apart from men because we're like, I don't know. It's just sometimes it gets a little bit too much for me. And I just am like, just go ride and who cares, like if you're with guys or girls. And I don't know. Kind of like that. I think there's a line, and I think just trying to balance it. And I think just keep, I think what women in the sport and men in the sport just need to keep being celebrated because they're doing insane things. Like that's the bottom line, is that this, they're risking their lives out there and just, it is a hustle. It's not all glamorous. It's a damn hustle. Like you're a part athlete and these days, like pretty much a robot. And you're also a business, like you have to manage yourself. And
Yeah, each athlete is their own brand, I suppose.
You take on a lot of responsibilities with that. And every time you, like, every time you do something like this, like, for example, this podcast, or you go do a pink bike hot lap, or whatever it is, you put out a video, you're putting yourself out there, and you're totally vulnerable to people's judgments and things like that. So you just have to kind of, like, you gotta get over that part of it as well.
Yeah. The pink bike forum will be ready for you.
Ready with their claws out.
Fantastic. All right. Well, we're getting pretty close to the end of our time, but we'll hit up our three questions that we ask everybody. So first one of those, it's £150, but we've converted that. I think that's about $260 Canadian. So if our listeners had that amount to spend to improve their performance on the bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
I definitely would suggest getting some coaching, like a clinic, a quick clinic with somebody in their area. Because I think everyone can benefit from that, like, no matter what level you're at, just to make sure that you're doing yourself all the favors you can. I think that's an investment that can go a long way on the trail. Yeah. Well, a pair of tires is pretty important. A pair of tires and a little tire gauge. Sure. That's not a bad idea.
And do you guys have a go-to tire that you use most of the year, or do you vary it up quite a lot?
I have my go-to tire combo that I mainly use, and then I'll stray from it slightly depending on the weather and the terrain. But usually I run, and I mean, at this point, I don't really have, I'm not officially working with any of these brands, but I just love the Maxxis Minion DHF for the front and the DHR for the rear. Yeah. I just love that trusty combo. Obviously 3C compound.
Oh, cool. Perfect Whistler tires.
Yeah. And just the right tire pressures.
Yeah. So go on then. What tire pressure do you run?
It depends. Like if it's trail or DH, they're quite similar actually.
Right.
And I adjust it to the weather, but usually I'll run, for me, anywhere between like 19 and 23 in the front, and maybe like 25 right. and 28 in the rear. It depends. Okay. And maybe I'll stray outside of that depending on what I'm, if I'm racing something or but that's ideal for me and my weight, I guess.
Yeah, going softer when it's wetter.
Totally.
Generally, cool. All right. Good. Question number two. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give her?
I think that girl needed a little bit more confidence. So I would try to instill some of that into her somehow and just, I guess, reassure her that. Just stay strong and go out, like, follow your dreams confidently. And also just, continue, live with your heart open and let opportunities come in that way. But also don't forget to use your head. Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. And have you learned any kind of techniques over the years to help with the confidence side of things? Is there anything that you do personally that helps you feel better about
I
situations?
Think, you know what? Like, it's taken me a long time. I was kind of a shy kid, and then, you know, growing up and then losing my mom, I think that really, I think I would obviously, I missed that confidence from her. But it's taken me a long time to become confident. So I think it's important to, for someone like me, I guess, guy or girl, to, you know, look to other people for chunks of it, like, not just vampire off of them, but like have a friend that gives you, you know, one friend, you have a friend and maybe she gives you confidence in these situations. You can learn from that and like take some of that as your own. And then maybe, you know, your brother or your dad, or, you know, you can learn a lot from the people in your, like in your circle. And then eventually you just get pissed off and you're like, you know what, you could just get some confidence. And like, you start getting, as you get older and wiser, you just get more confident and you give less F's about what people think. And yeah. So it does happen eventually, but I definitely think it took me a lot longer than a lot of kids these days anyways, have way more confidence in life than I did when I was their age. It's pretty cool to see that.
Yeah, definitely. It's amazing. All right, final question. If you could have a coaching session with anybody, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Oh, God, this is like, wow. Well, you know what? I have been lucky enough to ride with so many amazing riders, obviously, because I was, you know, friends with them or, you know, with them on the World Cup. So you do pick up things from here and there from people, like, for example, Tracy Mosley, when I raced the Trans-Provence. Obviously, she's someone I really look up to and admire. But I'd have to go back to Anne-Caroline Chausson because she's just someone I've always looked up to and admired in a huge way. And now with everything she's going through, and I don't know, I'd be interested to head out on a ride with her for sure.
Yeah. Is there anything specific you'd kind of want to talk about or want to get her to show you, or?
Not really. I think just hanging out and getting to know the person is more interesting to me. And like, obviously I admire her skill. I remember watching her come through the Riverside jumps at Whistler, and it was taking me like, it took me like a month to get through the big set. I kept coming back there, and she just showed up and flowed through it like nothing. Yeah. Wow. And just like, I know she's super skilled and everything like that, but I don't know. I definitely look towards the people that were in the sport back then, at the top of their game back then. There's just something I respect about that, the way that it was back then. It's so different from now. And I don't know what it is. It's like, you know, it was like the golden era or something. I don't know.
Yeah. It was a lot more raw, wasn't it? I guess.
Yeah, it really was. It was less robotic. Not that it sucks now. It's unreal. It's amazing, but
yeah, it's different. Yeah, a lot more professionalism, I guess. Like, everyone's got trainers and mm-hmm. you know, nutritionists and all this side of things. It's different to back in the day.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, all right.
A bit before my time, but she was still, like, she had retired when I was kind of still coming up. But yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, good stuff. Right. Well, we're out of time for today, but it's been a real pleasure chatting and finding out more about you. If people want to kind of keep in touch or look at what you're up to, where's the best place for them to look? Is it Instagram or?
Yeah, I think probably, yeah, Instagram. I try to post on there regularly, and my stories can give you like more of a fun insight. I think that's a good way, yeah, to follow somebody.
Cool. Yeah, we'll put that link in the show notes, and we'll put a link to the Kavaret Racing website as well, so people can find that if they want to have a look.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
All right. Good stuff. Well, I hope you have a wonderful rest of the year, and yeah, thank you for coming on.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Nice one. Cheers, Claire.
See ya.
Well, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening. I know that I certainly took a lot from my conversation with Claire. A massive thanks to KushCore and the Trailhead Bicycle Company for supporting this episode. Head to kushcore.com if you're interested in getting your hands on some of these awesome inserts so you can feel the benefits for yourself. And don't forget to show your local bike shop some love. And if you're in Shropshire, then why not give the Trailhead shop ride a go? You can also check out their website at thetrailhead.co.uk. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Just search for @downtimepodcast. Get subscribing to make your life easier and get each episode delivered to your device as soon as it's available. And a final reminder, our tech and product focused episodes won't be appearing on any channels other than ours. So if you want to hear those, then get subscribed. If you want to support what we're doing, then you can visit our webshop, downtimepodcast.com/shop, where we've got t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts and mugs. But most of all, please keep telling your friends about this podcast and sharing our episodes on social media. I know that loads of you do that, and I want to say a massive thank you. It really does help. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up real soon, but until then, get out and ride.